I'm Evan Kleinman of Angeli Cafe, and this is Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Does America have regional food? I'll ask the king and queen of eating on the road about their favorite sandwiches across the country. California's regional specialty has to be sushi. We take a 4 a.m. drive to LA's fish markets with a local chef looking for the best catch. And the sushi economy is huge. What the embrace of this Japanese delicacy has done to the international fish trade. First, let's see what's in season this week at the area farmers markets.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We're visiting with Mark Conley, who is a cheese connoisseur aficionado, and he's currently at the Santa Monica markets representing Winchester Cheese's handmade farmstead Gouda cheese, as well as a wonderful, exciting new producer, Rinconada sheep's milk cheese. And Mark, can you tell us a little bit about both of them?
Well, the Winchester company's been making cheeses in California for about 30 to 40 years. Jules Westling came here with an ancient recipe, started making cheese. And the nice thing about his cheeses are they're all raw milk. They've been aged for 60 days. And the cows are treated extraordinarily well. In fact, you know the California Happy Cows commercial? It's actually filmed at his ranch. Because his cows actually come in on their own to be milked.
Oh, that's so good to hear. And he is Jules Westling. He is Dutch.
Yes.
And this is the Gouda cheese. And let's talk about the aging process, because I know he's got the mild, the medium, and then the aged.
He actually ages up to a year and a half. And so his first cheese is the mild. The mild Gouda has been aged for 60 days. It's got a nice, buttery, kind of a slightly tart, tight finish. And then it goes all the way up to the super aged, which has been aged for 12 to 18 months. And it's extraordinarily tight. It's actually cheese that you want to use for grating.
It's like a Parmesan.
It's exactly like a Parmesan, but as far as the grating, but the taste is much sharper. And in fact, you could taste, it's a really good mark of a well-aged cheese is when you eat it. And you get a little of the protein crystals that are left in your mouth after the cheese is dissolved.
Yeah, I've found those, yeah. And now the sheep's milk cheese, it's from a dairy near Santa Barbara, and it's a uniquely different flavor. And so Can you try to describe that? And then let's talk about the varieties they have.
Well, sheep's milk, to begin with, is about the healthiest milk there is. A ewe will only produce about a quart of milk a day, where a cow will produce 4 gallons. It's full of calcium and a lot of omega-3 fats. But as far as the flavor goes, it's a much earthier flavor.
But not quite as earthy as the goat.
No, not even. These cheeses, she makes two cheeses. One of them is called La Panza Gold, which actually was an experimental cheese last year, and she just made it for the heck of it, and she actually won a gold medal for sheep's milk cheeses last year.
Is it a hard cheese?
They're both hard cheeses. Okay. This is a Corsican-style cheese, and then she actually rubs it every day with a sheep's milk whey to give it a little bit of a rind. Uh-huh. And the entire cheese-making process is done by a 60-year-old woman. She does everything by herself, as far from milking the ewes to hand-lading the curds, weighing the cheese, milking the cheese, lambing the animals. And that's a Corsican-style cheese. It's really buttery. It's earthy. It's kind of tight. Both cheeses will pick up flavor as they age. Her second cheese is her flagship cheese. It's called Pozo Tome. The Pozo Tome is a fantastic dessert cheese. I like it with a nice little bit of raw honey dipped on it. Both of these dairies are what they call farmstead cheesemakers, which means the farm is where the cheese is made. The milk doesn't leave the premise.
Mm-hmm.
So they have complete control of the milk. And, you know, all you need to make world-class cheeses is world-class milk and a dedicated cheesemaker. And both of these places have it.
You're here at the Wednesday Santa Monica, the Saturday Santa Monica. Are you going to other markets with this line of cheese
as
well?
Yes, I am. I'm in Palisades and Brentwood and Encino on Sundays.
Mm-hmm.
On Saturdays, we're in Torrance.
And that's Santa Monica downtown Saturday on Arizona.
Exactly.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mark Conley. He is selling cheese for two wonderful raw milk farmstead cheese producers here in California. We've got the Winchester cheese Gouda from cow's milk, and then we have the Rinconada sheep's milk cheese, and they're both delicious. We're visiting now with Scott Peacock, who grows in Dinuba and Arroyo Grande. But the eggplant that Scott grows is coming from?
It comes from Dinuba because eggplant is a hot weather crop. We start out with this one, which is new for us this year. This is called Clara. It's an Italian eggplant. It's like the globe eggplant. Has a little thicker skin. It has a very creamy texture, no seeds, and not a bit of bitterness. So we're going to see how that goes.
It's snow white.
As opposed to this, and this is the traditional globe. It's the Italian eggplant. Now this is a Beatrice. Rosa Bianca and Beatrice. This one I introduced last year, and this is the one that has the light, fluffy texture.
Like the Rosa Bianca.
And this is the one that you like so well.
Yes. Okay. Now, describe the color, though.
Okay, it's a zebra stripe. White streaks and red streaks. It's very, very, and this is a very, very sound eggplant. Nice and firm, and it's a nice keeper. You know, some of it is a little delicate, and you know, people squeeze it once or twice. I have to turn my squeeze meter on.
Yeah.
And when they squeeze it twice, it's a nickel a squeeze.
Okay.
And I charge them for that.
You must make a fortune.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
This black one, long cylindrical eggplant, is very, very delicate. Jet black, and the calyx is black. This one is the most delicate one, and whenever we get a Japanese customer, they go for this one. They know exactly what it is, and they love it.
And the great thing about all these kind of varieties of eggplant here is that they're not as bitter. You don't need to salt them and sweat them. And then they also don't seem to be picking up as much oil when you cook them because they're a finer flesh.
Yeah, that's very true. And especially one that's light and fluffy like that, Rosa Bianca. That's why people like that. For eggplant parmesan, they don't pick up the oils and things, so it remains light and fluffy, and it just makes the dish very, very nice.
Okay, Scott, well, we'll look for more to come. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That was Scott Peacock, and he, as he said, has 6 varieties of eggplant today. He's going to be coming in with 9, and it's that time of year when they're first out, and they're beautiful. Next Wednesday, be sure to join us at the Santa Monica Farmers Market at 3rd and Arizona. We're going to be welcoming Chef Joe Miller, who is the owner-chef of Joe's Restaurant on Abikini. He's going to cook some great food, and we'll sell small plates to the public so you can taste what Joe is cooking with the market produce. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Once a month, I take a trip to the Santa Monica Farmers Market with a video crew, and I cook outside. It's always a fun challenge, and the results can be downloaded and viewed on our website at kcrw.com/goodfood. This month, I show you how to make the easiest peach pie ever. The Good Food videos are also available on iTunes and on YouTube. Check it out. I'd love to know what you think. I'm going to get you hungry today. First, let's see what to eat around town. Jonathan Gold won the Pulitzer Prize this year for criticism, and we get to benefit each week with a restaurant he's found that meets the gold standard. That's next on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Jonathan Gold is with us for another wonderful opportunity to eat today somewhere incredibly delicious. Where are we going?
We're going to Koreatown.
Ooh, I love that. What are we eating?
We are eating chicken. We are in an all-chicken restaurant called Kumsan.
Is that a usual thing, or is it sort of a modern gimmicky kind of idea?
One of the wonderful things about Korean restaurants is a lot of them specialize, and some of them specialize to an extreme extent. So you'll go in there and you'll have nothing but a beef noodle soup, or you'll go into another restaurant and, you know, everybody orders the sort of inner dish thickened with blood, or you go into another dish and it's all blood sausage, and you go into another place and there's nothing but tiny little sushi rolls the size of your little finger.
So this is one for a wider audience, the all-chicken restaurant. And is it a barbecue-based thing or?
No. The main dish, and the dish that probably 80 or 90% of the people end up getting there, is the chicken ginseng stew called samgyetang.
So chicken ginseng. So it's made with a lot of ginseng.
There's a lot of ginseng. It's basically a double or triple strength broth brought out in a crock.
No, wait. When you say double or triple strength, are broths often diluted, or is this double or triple strength just because it's infused with so much stuff?
I'm saying it's a double strength broth because it's the broth they used to cook chickens in, and then they serve those chickens and they cook more chickens in it and serve you the chicken with that. So each broth has seen a lot of chickens pass through it.
That's wonderful.
And like a lot of Korean soups, it's very milky colored. The sort of froth that we tend to skim off if we're not Korean to make, you know, consomme clear. They stir back into the soup, and they stir it back into the soup, and they stir it back into the soup. So it's very, it's like a milky, cloudy, you know, beautiful sort of yellowy pale.
Does it have a kind of funk factor to it because of that?
There's definitely bone in it. I mean, you know when you can taste broths that have been made with a lot of bones, but it's not funky. It doesn't have a high smell or anything.
And the ginseng. Now, ginseng is a very specific kind of flavor. Could you try and describe it?
It has a slightly musky, sharp pungency to it. The way that this dish comes out is you get a crock of soup, and in the crock of soup, like a giant matzo ball, is a chicken, a whole chicken, small, about a pound. And in the chicken is a forcemeat of pulled garlic cloves, sticky rice, and half of a ginseng root. And the ginseng doesn't flavor the soup incredibly, but it definitely flavors the flesh of the chicken. It's just beautiful.
And is it spicy?
It's not spicy at all.
That's really interesting because so much of Korean cuisine seems to rely so heavily on the chili.
There's a special sauce that they bring out that you could put into the soup if you want, which you don't have to do. There's actually so much flavor in the soup that I don't use the chili, and I use chili on everything, including my oatmeal in the morning. And there's flakes of roasted salt and sesame that you can sprinkle into the soup. It's a very, very comforting dish.
Does it have any aromatic vegetables flanking the chicken, like we would think of a chicken in the pot?
No, it doesn't. I'm sure that vegetables have given their lives during the making of the broth, but it's naked broth chicken.
And usually, is there one of these pots per person, or does one share?
You could have one per person. In fact, most people probably do. There's another option, which is a particularly pleasant one, where they bring out a big metal pot and they put it on a burner, and there's the broth in it, and there's basically one chicken for every person at the table. When you're done eating that, they whisk the broth away, and they come back with guksu, which are those wonderful hand-cut Korean noodles that they simmer in the soup till they become really soft and really slithery, and they give you a bowl of that afterwards.
Wow, that sounds great.
It's sort of their basic combo meal, but for, you know, $20 a person, I don't think you could go wrong. It's just delicious.
So once again, give us the name of the restaurant and the address.
The name of the restaurant is Kumsan, and the address is 1144 Southwestern in Koreatown.
Thanks so much, Jonathan.
Thank you.
Jonathan Gold is the Pulitzer Prize-winning critic for the LA Weekly. He's with us nearly each week with another restaurant to try. Check out some of his past recommendations on our website at kcrw.com/goodfood. One of the best things about traveling around this summer is getting to eat new foods. There's a pair whose full-time job is driving around and finding the best shacks and stands, road food, and the best sandwiches across the country. That's coming up next on Good Food. Traveling back roads of America, eating road food. For Jane and Michael Stern, dream life doesn't begin to characterize their extraordinary career of 30-plus years of eating the roads and byways of America. This time, their focus in their latest book are sandwiches, road food sandwiches, to be exact. You know, I have to tell you that the longer I'm on this planet and the more I cook myself, the more I want to eat sandwiches. Why is that?
You're an American, and
well, thank you.
Yes, you're welcome. It is really the most all-American food because Americans are always on the go. And they, you know, we don't sit down and have four-course lunches like in Italy or France. We're people in a hurry, and putting something between two pieces of bread and running around is much more our style.
Furthermore, I would say that the thing about sandwiches is that, with a few exceptions, they're very democratic, small d, of course, in that it's almost impossible to be a sandwich snob.
I find them so completely satisfying. Maybe it's because every single course is within those two pieces of bread.
Well, I want to know what your favorite sandwiches are.
Oh, man. I'm a tuna melt person.
Did you happen to notice that Road Food Sandwiches has San Diego's best tuna melt recipe in it?
Oh, I'm so happy, because my next question was going to be, does California still have any road food?
Oh, without a doubt. In fact, I think we have two different recipes from a place in La Jolla, just outside of San Diego, called The Cottage. And this is Southern California road food supreme. It's a breezy bungalow not too far from the ocean, frequented not only by the kind of wealthy La Joyans, but by genuine surfers. In fact, the guy who runs it is himself a surfer. And the food there is really fresh, light, fun California food.
In fact, the guy who runs it is one of the original characters in Tom Wolfe's essay, The Pump House Boys, about surfers. He's an old surfer dude, and he still gets on his board and goes out every afternoon.
And in addition to the San Diego's best tuna melt recipe that we got from them, which includes a little bacon, you make it on sourdough bread, you use Parmesan cheese instead of old American cheese.
You must have to get off the major roads to find this food, because the major roads just seem to be one plastic chain after another.
It struck us recently that there is no food on major roads anymore. In the old days, there used to be truck stops, but now you have to get off at an exit, and at every exit, there is this quad of, you know, fast food places, one across the street from each other. Michael and I probably have peed in every one of these places in America, but we don't choose to eat there.
And in fact, the point, of course, is that what we're always looking for when we're looking for road food is the one-of-a-kind restaurant, the place that has real character.
Do sandwiches have a regional flavor in this country?
Without a doubt. Just take the simple hot roast beef sandwich. I mean, if you live in Buffalo, New York, you will call it beef on weck and serve it on a caraway seed dotted roll. If you live in Chicago, you're going to call it Italian beef and serve it with jardinera or roasted peppers. If you're in New Orleans, it's a po' boy with debris and gravy on it.
With debris?
Debris, they call
debris.
It in New Orleans.
So
what debris
so
is all the little bits and pieces that fall off the roast when you cut it, all those savory little delicious parts.
Fabulous.
You want that piled into your roast beef sandwich.
What's the Philippe's in Los Angeles called, their version
Philippe,
of it?
Philippe's,
French dip.
The French dip, of course. That used to be unique to Southern California, but now you find French dips mostly throughout the West and even beyond that.
Yeah, and here's another regionalism. Some parts of the country say sandwich. Some people say sandwich. Some people say samish. Some people say torpedo, hoagie, grinder, blimpy, zeppy. You almost can't even order a sandwich in most parts of the country unless you speak that regional lingo.
And what about the bread? Is the bread in your favorite road food sandwiches made of actual bread, or is it okay for that part of the sandwich to be of the industrialized variety?
It
depends on the sandwich.
If you're talking about a corned beef sandwich, you absolutely need really good, slick-crusted, sturdy sourdough rye bread.
If you want like a luncheonette-style grilled cheese sandwich, you know, one of those sandwiches that winds up about a quarter of an inch high and with all the cheese gushing out, you need white bread. We love good bread, but we also love crappy bread. You know, you cannot have a barbecue sandwich without getting just Wonder Bread or Sunbeam bread. And you know it's a great barbecue sandwich because the pitmaster usually pushes the whole sandwich together with his hand. So there's like a big handprint in the white bread on the top.
The sign of excellence.
Oh, I love that. But it also makes the bread more compact. So let's come back to California, because I would love to hear more of the places in our state that really turn you on.
We got a really great deli sandwich recipe from a place called DZ Aiken's. It's a real old-fashioned Jewish deli in San Diego. All kinds of great Jewish food. But the fresher we had to put in there because it is the ultimate of – you know how real delis have those like outrageous sandwiches piled with like like chopped liver and corned beef and pastrami.
And tongue.
I've never known anyone to actually consume one of those, Michael. Are you one?
I am one to order one and then order maybe 6 or 8 extra slices of bread to like spread it out into four, deconstruct it and then reconstruct it as 4 sandwiches. But in fact, what we got from DZ Aiken's was a recipe for what they call the fresser. And of course, fresser, if you know your Yiddish, means big eater. And this is a recipe for a sandwich on rye that includes corned beef, pastrami, roast turkey, roast beef, Swiss cheese, tomato, and mustard.
The tomato seems a bit gratuitous to me.
I know. And a pickle on the side, of course.
Of course. I love this book. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks
so much.
For talking
it's always
to
fun
us.
To talk to you.
Road Food Sandwiches is the latest book from Jane and Michael Stern. They travel across the country finding the best of the out-of-the-way foods. I've got links to their great website and recipes on our site at kcrw.com/goodfood. The regional food of California has got to be sushi. What does it take to get all that high-quality fish at a sushi restaurant? Next, Good Food producer Thea Challoner goes on a ride-along with a sushi chef at 4 a.m. to get the best of the daily catch. That's in 1 minute, right here on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com.
For those of us unaccustomed to starting the day at 3:30 in the morning, here's what it's like.
This better be good.
Driving to Sasabune, Nobi Kusuhara's restaurant, I glide through 4 green lights in a row and hardly put my foot on the brake. I park my car at the restaurant and wait for about 19 seconds. At 4:29 exactly, 2 men in a van appear. The window rolls down. A Japanese man in a baseball hat looks out at me, says nothing. I jump in, and we're off. Just when I'm thinking this is going to be some kind of serious operation.
So you want to grab a coffee?
Sure, yes, coffee sounds good.
Nobi and his assistant pick up the coffee, 2 boxes of donuts, gifts for the men at the fish market, and 1 sugar twist for me.
Donuts.
For everybody.
I'm picturing 1 central location for all the fish, something like Seattle. But Nobi reminds me, this is L.A. Nothing is central.
Here, we don't have a fish market, Los Angeles. So we have an individual company, maybe 40, 50 different company.
40 or 50?
Nobi's been working in the fish industry for 35 years. His mentor was sushi master Nobu Nozawa. Our first stop is the International Fish Company. Nobi and his assistant jump out of the van and run inside. I wander in behind them.
Good morning.
Under glaring fluorescent lights, a whole lot of dead fish piled high on ice stare back at me. Eel, mackerel, tuna, salmon, giant clams in shells the size of your hand held together with rubber bands, their bodies looking a lot like deflated phalluses pushing out of their shells. There's tiny smelt with streamlined snouts, abalone hidden inside iridescent shells, and a few sea creatures I have no idea how to identify. Nobi's assistant puts on plastic gloves and gets to work.
So what are these?
Abalone.
Abalone, oh wow.
This is from Santa Barbara.
About 20 men in hairnets and aprons are working furiously, stacking more fish on ice, scaling 5-foot-long salmon with giant knives. In a back room, a piece of bluefin tuna flesh runs the entire length of an 8-foot stainless steel table. Nobi inspects it immediately.
I'm just picking up the tuna here, and right now I'm waiting for the Hawaiian aku, which is a skipjack. It's coming from airport right now, so...
Outside in the darkness, I notice several men hustling a big crate inside Nobi's van. They do it fast and walk away quickly. I don't ask. Once we're back in the van, Nobi explains.
Mm-hmm. They have only a few uni, sea urchin too.
Okay.
They hide it in the box and then give it to me.
Okay. Score today.
Yes.
Competition for choice seafood is fierce. And it's not unusual for markets to hide fish for sushi men like Nobi. He's earned the privilege. For fish to taste good, a lot depends on how they get to market. When they're shipped swimming around inside tanks, in trucks, or airplanes, the trauma is often too much for them.
Then they get a nervous breakdown.
You heard him right. The fish get a nervous breakdown. Trauma shows up as a cloudy white strip along the backbone of the fish. Not only is it cruel, but it makes the fish taste bitter. So the Japanese have figured out a smart and humane way to solve the problem. After the fish are caught, the water in the tanks is kept just above freezing.
Then fish start sleeping in the water. You know, they just stay there in one place.
They're sleeping in this semi-frozen state, and then once they arrive in the restaurant, they're dumped in tanks filled with warmer water.
At the moment when they hit the water, they wake up, boom, comes up, live, you know, just like jump over top of the water. They have so much energy.
In the world of sushi, the life of a fish matters. For a top chef like Nobi, it matters a great deal. We head to two more markets, and the drill is the same. Nobi and his assistant run in, quickly assess the day's catch, grab what they need, and zoom off, just as the sun begins to rise. Three markets in under an hour, for one day's supply of fish, 5 mornings a week. Sasabune is one of Los Angeles's top-rated sushi restaurants. Since Nobi's mentor was Nozawa, best known as the original sushi Nazi, I was curious to hear his philosophy on dealing with customers.
I have my way to make sushi. If the people come to me and say, can you make this, can you make this? I'm sorry, I can't do it. You know, that's not my style. You know, the food business is, I always believe, like a concert, okay? So if I make like a music on the food and between somebody make a noise, it's not good, right? Ruin the whole concert.
Later that day, I come back to the restaurant for a taste of the day's catch. This is what I remember. Tuna albacore sashimi, toro, halibut, bonita, yellowtail, salmon, scallop, and kampachi sushi on warm rice, and one blue crab roll. It was, in a word, perfect.
I like that sometimes the customer comes in, like, you know, one lady comes in the table eating by herself. But I can see she's moving body, you know, just go, wow, go like this. And it just, I can see the sign, oh, she liked my fish, you know? That's the whole day for me.
Makes you happy?
Yes, it does.
For Good Food, this is Thea Challoner.
There's no question that sushi is big business. The demand for high-quality fish has created pirates on the open seas and other forces, large and small. I'll be right back with stories of the modern sushi economy. That's next on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Mackerel. They used to be synonyms for cat food, but we now pay the big bucks to enjoy them atop a nicely shaped piece of rice. Philadelphia-based journalist Sasha Eisenberg ate sushi in 14 countries and 5 continents over the course of 2 years researching his book, The Sushi Economy, Globalization and the Making of a Modern Delicacy. It's great to have you here.
Thanks so much for having me.
Is it possible to give us a brief history of sushi's journey from unknown American cuisine to modern delicacy?
Sure. Sushi started fairly recently in Japan as well. In the 19th century, it was a street snack in Tokyo. And the sushi bars we know at the wooden counter and the standing chef and the seated diner didn't really become familiar to the Japanese until the post-war period. And at that time, Japan was sort of undergoing this big corporate diaspora, sending out executives and business travelers and tourists. And Los Angeles was one of the first destinations for this sort of Japanese business culture abroad. And along with these sort of new global adventurers came expense accounts and a sort of taste for the sushi bar. And it was in Los Angeles beginning in 1962 that sushi bars popped up in the United States. And Los Angeles has always been 10, 15 years ahead of the rest of the country in sort of acculturating sushi into the diet and lifestyle. And by a generation ago, you began to see sushi in mall food courts and supermarkets and stadiums.
Is the sushi economy vertically integrated from boat to purveyor who sells to the local bar?
No. I mean, you have these sort of vast trade networks that often it'll be 6, 8, 10 people who've sort of handled your fish across continents, across days, across currencies. And they're very often very stable trade networks, but they haven't been integrated. And no corporation has sort of figured out how to bring economies of scale to it. So what you have is you have these really strong tie between a fisherman and his dealer, and that dealer has a really strong connection with a freight forwarder who has a really strong connection with a cargo guy who has a really strong connection with a wholesaler, and all the way on to your chef. And what you have is you have sort of the old-fashioned ties persist in maintaining that chain at each step, but it's happening in a sort of global environment in this really dynamic scene.
I remember when tuna cost nothing, very, very, very inexpensive. Is part of the reason it's so expensive now because of the demand from sushi?
Yes. I mean, in the United States, red fish was unwanted until a generation ago. And fish meant something that was white, or in the case of salmon, pink. But up until the early 1970s, American fishermen who caught tuna would, if they were lucky, they'd get 10 cents a pound to have it sold as cat food. If they were unlucky, they'd have to pay the town dump to take it off their hands. And what happened was the Japanese demand in the 1970s, once an American supply for tuna became connected with the Japanese demand for it, shot up in value. And you have this 10,000% increase in value from 1970 to 1990 for tuna caught out of the Atlantic.
Now, who are the tuna cowboys of Australia?
While American fishermen started doing well in the 1970s, you had a similar scene in Australia where on the southern coast, a bunch of mostly immigrants from the Mediterranean, these wild fishermen, these really risky guys would go out and hunt the southern bluefin tuna for export to Japan, and they were sort of celebrated in Australia as the tuna cowboys. And during the 1980s, for a number of reasons, including seemingly overfishing, their fishery fell into disrepair, and they made one big gamble, and that was to try to figure out the science and economics of tuna ranching, which meant, unlike farming, which means breeding fish in captivity, it means taking fish in the wild, dragging them live into pens off of a coast where they can be fattened and then harvested on schedule when they're sort of an optimal size and when the market conditions are best. And this bet quickly paid off, and within a year or two, they'd done this amazing thing, which is they had taken this hunter-gatherer practice of catching fish in the wild, and they had grafted onto it these sort of factory-style industrial economics that allowed them to sort of create a predictable flow of valuable fish. And these tuna cowboys have now become tuna moguls, and this town, Port Lincoln, that's the sort of center of the Australian tuna business, is the wealthiest town in the southern hemisphere in the world, packed with millionaires, one of whom spent his fortune on a mansion, and his architectural genius was to buy the plans for the South Fork Ranch from the TV show Dallas and have his have an architect reconstructed on the hills of South Australia, at which point his neighbor responded by building a house that people call Dynasty.
Oh, that's so funny. So many of us have seen this incredible fish market in Tokyo on documentaries, but you've actually been there. Try and bring it to life for us.
Tsukiji Fish Market was built in the 1920s, and the sort of physical home of it is still looks a lot like that. It's a sort of concrete and Bauhaus glass shed that in Tokyo is really anomalous in being old and sort of decrepit in its infrastructure. But there are 1,600 traders, 400 of them who deal in tuna, these wholesalers who are every day competing for tens of millions of dollars of seafood that's coming from every ocean on Earth. These trucks come over the bridge every night. They used to be from boats unloading their fish in the harbor. Now most of them are coming in from the Narita Airport, which people refer to as Japan's top fishing harbor. And you sort of see the new global reach of the Japanese seafood consumer at work here. And these 400 guys are sort of scrambling in these auctions that are something between Sotheby's and the old Chicago stockyards and a mercantile exchange. They're paying $10,000, $30,000 at auction in a matter of seconds for an individual tuna that they've graded without seeing a full cut of its meat.
That's extraordinary. Sasha, it's really a fascinating book, and I thank you so much for your passion and intellect in bringing this deep look at sushi to us.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
That was Sasha Eisenberg, Philadelphia-based journalist and author of The Sushi Economy, Globalization and the Making of a Modern Delicacy. What do the hot, spicy, and unknown foods of southern Thailand have to do with corn-fed steaks in America? Not much, really, but we'll talk about them both with the editor of Savour magazine. That's coming up next on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Can't help but have it on the brain once the summer grilling season begins, but many of us are questioning those gorgeous, tender corn-fed steaks and if they're worth the environmental cost and less than humane treatment of the animals. Also, what about Thai food? I have a feeling there's something there that we haven't quite learned about. James Osland, editor of Savour, is here to share the good and the bad of meat processing and tantalize us with some Thai favorites of his. So steak, let's get right into it. Should we completely stop eating those beautiful corn-fed steaks?
Oh, no, you shouldn't. You should eat the steak that you like the best, the steak that tastes the best. But certainly grass-fed beef does have a lot of things in its favor. It really, really is a much more humane, much more sound way to go about raising cattle.
And have you found during your recipe testing at the magazine mm-hmm. that you have to treat grass-fed steak in a completely different way?
We haven't really found that so much. I mean, I've heard inklings of that out in the world of beef cookers, but we really didn't find that so much, not in our direct immediate experience. A good steak is a good steak.
And what is a good steak?
Oh, one with luscious fat marbled through it. There's a ranch that we cover in this issue of Savour, in the June-July issue of Savour, that's actually one of the United States' largest cattle ranches, and it's in Montana, and it's owned by a Frenchman, and it's called La Sense, or La Sense. L-A is the first word, and C-E-N-S-E is the next word. And they raise entirely grass-fed beef, and it produces steaks of just extraordinarily good quality. So maybe that just shoots down my corn-fed affection.
Now, what about cut? In the process of doing this issue, did you come upon cuts that you really, really loved? And did you find a way of cooking where we at home can actually eat steak as good as when we go out to a great steakhouse?
Yes to both questions. I think our really ultimately favorite be-all, end-all cut, and truly one of the most luxurious cuts of steak that there is a porterhouse, a good, wonderful porterhouse where on one side of that bone you've got this really fantastic filet mignon, so tender, so full of flavor, and on the other side you've got a nice big chunk of New York strip, and the two of those together, gosh, they're just a match made in heaven. And what we figured out this really amazing way of, I guess you could say replicate, but in a way it almost takes it a step further. But that method of cooking steaks that happens in a good American steakhouse, we figured out how to do it at home. It involves only one or two pieces of equipment, and it's very much indoors. America's best steakhouses, they're all using broilers or grills, of course. But the thing is, what their kitchens allow them to do is raise the temperature of those grills or broilers to a good 1,000 degrees or more.
Oh, my gosh.
Our ovens, it's truly, truly incendiary. Our home ovens, of course, don't go that high. But what we recommend doing is opening all the windows in your kitchen, first and foremost. You want to preheat your oven for a good 30 minutes, and really even up to an hour or so, almost like you're creating a kind of pizza oven, if you will, really, really hot. Then with your nicest cast iron skillet that you can get, first you're going to pan sear the piece of meat. You're going to want to preheat that cast iron skillet just on the stovetop for a good 5-10 minutes or so. And you're going to want to get the steak to almost charcoal-like side. Then you're going to flip it, cook it for a good 2 minutes or so. After you've done that, throw it into that super mega-hot oven for a good 6 to 8 minutes or so. Keep in mind that a porterhouse is a pretty substantial piece of meat. It's, you know, can be a good 2.5-3 inches thick. Then take it out, put 2, 3, 4 nice thick slices of butter on top and let it rest, which allows the juices of the steak to really go back into the meat and recirculate. Serve it, plate it, you have like food of the gods.
Oh my, my. So now let's completely switch gears. I know that you have traveled a lot in Asia, and I understand that you recently took a trip to Thailand.
That's right. It's a not-so-explored part of Thailand. I mean, one of my very favorite regional cuisines in Thailand lies in the deep south, very close to the Malaysia border. It's a part of Thailand that is pretty much 50-50 Muslim-Buddhist mix throughout. And it's got a very distinct culture and certainly a very distinct culinary culture versus other parts of Thailand that you'll travel to.
What is the palate there? Is it the same spicy, sweet, hot, sour that we find often in the rest of Thailand?
That's absolutely true. But I think one thing that you'll find that sort of separates it from the other foods is an emphasis on the spicy, and not so much spicy from chilies, though they are just absolutely wild about chilies there, but spice. This part of Thailand was historically very important in the ancient spice trade.
Give us an example of a couple of dishes that you really love.
Well, certainly one of the ones that we're most familiar with here, and we can get it in virtually any North American Thai restaurant, and it's somewhat of a corruption of a true Southern Thai dish, but it's what's known as musaman curry, which literally means Muslim curry. That's a curry that's a coconut milk-based curry that uses a spice paste with lots of black pepper and cumin seeds and often coriander seeds and fresh galangal and lemongrass. There's a dish, though, that's served there more commonly called gangtai pla, which usually actually involves a variety of pork offal, pork innards, and lots of black pepper in the curry paste base. And, oh, it's just really, really a gorgeous, beautiful, fiery dish.
Oh, I just can't wait to go one day. Maybe you'll take me.
Oh, I'll go with you. Sure, sure. I'll go anytime.
Thank you so much, James.
Thanks so much for having me. Great, great to talk to you again.
James Osland is the editor of Savour magazine. His story and photos from southern Thailand are in the latest edition of the magazine. It's on newsstands now. It finally feels like summer, and there's no better way to cool down than with the fruity Mexican drinks known as aguas frescas. They're simple fruit drinks that are so refreshing. Let's sample some next with Loteria Grill owner Jimmy Shaw. That's coming up when Good Food continues. We'll be right back. As the weather starts to warm up, you might find yourself craving something different to drink. For many of us Californians, that means it's agua fresca time. Here to share some stories of aguas frescas is Jimmy Shaw, owner of the beloved Loteria at Farmers Market at 3rd and Fairfax. Hello.
Good morning.
You have brought me a rainbow of amazing liquid-filled carafes. Describe what an agua fresca is in its basic form.
Some people would call it a cooler or an aid. It's water drinks that you find throughout Mexico, and they're typically made with fresh fruit, water, and sugar. The beautiful thing about agua fresca is Mexico has such an incredible richness of beautiful fruits. And, you know, we're very fortunate in California that we also have an incredible richness of great, great produce. So aguas frescas are you would find them in any refrigerator in any home in Mexico. They will be sweet. We go for sweet.
Talk about horchata just for a minute, because as, you know, an Italophile, there's orgeat there, which is pretty much the same thing.
Horchata throughout Mexico is mostly made with rice. So our horchata is made with rice that we soak overnight. And then we blend in the morning with a little bit of condensed milk, evaporated milk. And by the way, when we soak it overnight, it's soaked with a little bit of clove and a lot of cinnamon.
So you're just using the water that's poured off from having soaked with the rice.
Correct. And then you put it through a fine sieve so that you get rid of some of the chalkiness. And in some places, they'll use almond as well. Mm-hmm. Or different kinds of nuts. You can do a peanut horchata. You can do a nut horchata.
To me, it's like drinking French toast. Or drinking rice pudding is what it is.
That's exactly what it's like. It's rice pudding. Exactly.
Okay. Let's talk about one that you know I've never had.
Oh, I know you've never had agua de pepino or agua de betabel.
Now, pepino I know is cucumber, and I love cucumbers. So, and the way many of us are used to eating cucumbers in the Mexican style is on a plate with some chile and some limon. So you've actually taken all those flavors and blended them up into a drink?
Yes.
Please excuse me while I drink. Okay, this is like my new favorite thing.
Isn't that delicious?
Now, you've added sugar to this?
It has a little bit of sugar.
And
it has
lemon.
Salt. And also, it has, in this case, I put a little bit of chile serrano into it. Now, imagine this with a little tequila.
Oh, I was imagining that.
That would be good.
That would be really good. How are you going to top that?
You know? Well, you have to try the agua de betabel or the beet
okay,
juice.
Okay, betabel is how you say betabel. Beets?
But that's done with a little bit of oranges.
Oh, my. That's an adult taste. That is delicious. But I love beets. To me, beets are like sweet dirt. Wow, that's delicious. Mm. Now, do you serve any of these oddities at Loteria?
You know, Loteria, we tend to serve the more regular ones. It was so incredibly fun making all of these this morning. We thought what we needed is a little chilling case to display them, because the rainbow of these is also incredible. Just beautiful.
Okay, now, there was one that you were talking about that was a fermented beverage.
Tepache. Throughout Mexican history, whether it's pulque or tepache or any number of fermented drinks, we have taken what the land gives us and we've let it ferment, and from that we get our boozy drinks. But tepache is what you do with pineapple and pineapple skin. This one has a little bit of cinnamon, a little bit of clove, but you can put other fruits in it as well.
Okay, now what I want to know is the process of preparing the fruit. So are you actually saving the meaty part of the fruit for another use?
Yes.
And you're using the leftover, because it's a frugal culture. So
correct.
You're getting a two-for-one, right?
Well, you know, and that's also the case about aguas frescas in general. Aguas frescas often are made with the fruit that you wouldn't be eating anymore. Or in a restaurant, they might be the fruit that was cut up for breakfast. Whatever's not used is prepared as the agua fresca for lunch. But in the case of tepache, yes, you absolutely get two for one on this. You will have eaten the pieces of pineapple in the morning, and you save the core, and you save the skin, and you put those into a non-reactive bowl with piloncillo, which is unrefined brown sugar, with a little bit of cinnamon and clove, and you leave it at room temperature for maybe 3 or 4 or 5 days, depending on what the temperature's like. You test it, and then...
What are you testing for? Light fizz?
Light fizz and just enough alcohol, you know, before it sours on you. And then you put it through a fine mesh and refrigerate it. And it's yummy. You want to try?
Yeah. So this is alcoholic?
Slightly.
Woohoo. Ooh, it's lovely. It looks like beer almost.
It does. You know, and this one actually, when I put it into this vessel, it's slightly carbonated.
Wow, that's really interesting. It's delicious. Now, many of these carafes that I'm looking at, I can see that there's enough of the pulp that the pulp has sort of floated to the top. Is that typical, or would normally they be so strained out that they would really be more like waters?
No, that's very typical, especially with fruits like watermelon or cantaloupe, which we have in this case here as well. Now, one of the things that you can do is you can mash them rather than blend them, and that will prevent a little bit of that happening, and you get a little more of the texture, which is also quite fun. Some people prefer that.
Turn me on to something else.
Let's see, tamarindo. Well, you know,
I love tamarindo.
Tamarindo's great. You have to be a little careful with it, and there are two ways to do it. You can do it either with a pulp that you buy or with the pods.
Now, these pods, when you see a tamarind pod, it sort of looks like a carob pod, but they're smaller, they're a little more puffy, and they're dry. They look very, very dry, like there's nothing you could do to them to rehydrate them.
Oh, you absolutely can, and there are two ways. You can either steep them or boil them, but you have to first peel them because they have this hard shell. You can crunch the shell and peel them.
So the shell comes off.
Yes.
And then what's inside, the sticky pulpy
the
stuff?
The sticky pulpy stuff. And it has two veins going on. It has a vein going on either side of it. So you have to peel those off. As intense.
Now, as we're going through these, are there certain types of foods that you think pair better with others? Or are these all just great with spicy tacos?
No, they definitely, for instance, the lime one to me goes really well with anything. It's fish. And you can do this, you know, with whatever you have in your fridge. That's the beauty of agua fresca. If you have gone to a farmer's market, you've got a couple things that are just about to get to the point where maybe you wouldn't eat them, but blend them up with enough sugar to taste and some water, and you've got a great drink. And
well, all of us end up throwing out lettuce and carrots. Can you do a lettuce and carrot agua fresca?
Do you know, if the pepino one is as delicious as it is, I don't see why not.
This has been so spectacular, Jimmy. Thank you very much.
Evan,
and we're definitely going to have pictures on our website of all of these because they're just beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Loteria Grill is one of my favorite places to eat in the city. Jimmy Shaw is the owner. We have some aguas frescas recipes on our site at kcrw.com/goodfood. I hope you'll try them and see how easy and delicious they are. Gluten is everywhere. And for those who suffer from celiac disease, gluten is a big no-no. If you're trying to avoid dairy and eating kosher too, you can forget about buying muffins and cakes at a bakery. But a new business has just opened that's filling the need for Angelinos. Next up on Good Food, how taking away ingredients can still taste good. Something sweet, but have some serious impediments to enjoyment, like a gluten allergy, for example? Well, soon, The Sensitive Baker will be a new place to turn. Eugenie Mason is one of the bakers there. Hi, Eugenie.
Hi.
The Sensitive Baker, just the name of it, it makes me imagine a place where people who have a lot of different allergies that prevent them from eating baked goods could go.
Exactly. We think that everyone has an urge to eat a muffin occasionally, a piece of pizza, a cupcake. And it's our goal for everyone to be able to have that satisfaction, regardless of an allergy that you might have or even just something to give your kids.
Tell me the things that you're trying to avoid. Wheat gluten?
We're avoiding all products that are made with gluten, which is not just wheat flour, actually. Rye, barley. There's a lot of other flours that have gluten in them, and it's an extra substance that a lot of people are very allergic to. So gluten is one thing, and then also dairy, which has casein, and that's a protein in milk that is a lot of times correlated with gluten allergies. And we are also, on top of all that, kosher. So a lot of people would think that our hands are tied behind our backs when we're baking.
So tell me a little bit about how handicapped you are. Mm-hmm. When we think about baking, those of us who cook, we think about flour, eggs, milk, butter. None of those are available to you.
Definitely not. And I agree. When I first started down this gluten-free baking path, I actually wondered, what are we going to make this stuff with? But it's kind of, you have a whole nother toolbox at your disposal.
So tell me what's in your toolbox. What are some of the ingredients that are in the toolbox?
Our secrets.
Are they weird? Are they really odd things?
No, they're things like almond milk, which is something that we use in place of dairy. And it's a fabulous ingredient. People buy it to put on their cereal, but it's a really good ingredient in baked goods. We use margarines, but obviously non-hydrogenated ones. We use oils that are, again, healthy polyunsaturated or monounsaturated oils. For eggs, we do have eggs in some products, but we have a product called Egg Replacer. And then we have things like we just do flour blends, because if you're making something with wheat, you know, a typical recipe would say for cookies would say wheat flour or all-purpose flour. But the flour combinations for a gluten-free item would be, you know, you have your brown rice flour, or your white rice flour, then you have a starch of some sort to lighten it up, because these flours just definitely do not perform in a way that you would expect. So you can't just sub out your all-purpose flour for a rice flour, for
because
example.
The point of gluten is that it creates these really long elastic proteins.
It's
that
a beautiful thing.
It is a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
That allows things to rise and trap air.
Right.
So it provides that structure. Mm-hmm. So how do you get that structure?
Yes, and that's the science. And there's an ingredient which it kind of might, you know, it sounds kind of terrifying actually, but it's the answer to all of our problems. It's called xanthan gum.
Now, xanthan gum is a natural thing.
It's a natural thing. It's actually created from the fermentation of glucose, I believe. Because when I first heard of it, I thought, wow, I eat naturally. I don't think that sounds like something that's going to be in my diet. But it is a natural product, and you'll find it in things like salad dressings. It basically keeps things emulsified, and it definitely stands in for gluten, and it holds that flour together so that when you open up your muffin, it doesn't turn to dust. And
that would be bad. And do you have special tasters that you run everything by? Is there a couple people that are in your group where you sort of use them as the arbiter of whether or not it's a successful product?
Well, we basically pull things out of the oven while they're still hot and rip them apart. Oh, is the texture right? Is the flavor right? But while we're in this development phase, we have been taking things home to our friends and family. And those are the best people, because they won't they won't mince their words, or they'll give it to you honestly. And I don't know if they're just telling me this, but they say things taste better than they do when they're made with regular flour.
So you've just opened pretty recently. What is turning out to be your biggest seller?
I definitely have to go with the cake, cupcakes, and cinnamon rolls, especially the cinnamon roll. I mean, the smell alone, it's a very sensory, fabulous experience. And then cupcakes, because they're just a nostalgic, fabulous thing that
people can't seem to get enough of.
Exactly. Exactly.
Thank you so much, Eugenie.
Thank you for having us. We're really excited to have you come by our bakery.
That was Eugenie Mason. She is one of the bakers at The Sensitive Baker. You can find them in Culver City. We'll have a link to them on our site at kcrw.com/goodfood. Sign up for our weekly Good Food newsletter and find every week's show. You can stream Good Food, download Good Food, and watch video episodes as well. Find it all on kcrw.com/goodfood. Good Food's executive producer is Jennifer Farrow. The show is produced by Thea Challoner with Bob Carlson, Candace Moyer, Connie Alvarez, and Holly Tarson. The music supervisor is Gary Masiha. Special thanks to Beth Xavier. I'm Evan Kleinman. Join me next week for another edition of Good Food.